From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, President Obama vows to work with the new Republican Congress. The relationship between the Obama administration and the Israeli government. Dangers facing journalists in Egypt.
Unfortunately, it's just simply not a place in which journalists feel as though they can operate freely and safely.
And the U.S. and Liberia open an Ebola treatment unit for health workers. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. A day after his Democratic Party was trounced in midterm elections, U.S. President Barack Obama vowed to work with the new Republican majority in Congress to ensure a prosperous future for Americans. VOA correspondent Aru Pandey has details from the White House.
Conceding that Republicans had a, quote, good night, winning a 52-seat majority in the U.S. Senate, President Barack Obama struck a measured tone, saying Americans had sent a clear message with their vote.
They expect the people they elect to work as hard as they do. They expect us to focus on their ambitions and not ours. They want us to get the job done. All of us in both parties have a responsibility to address that sentiment.
In a news conference in the East Room of the White House, the president cited areas of possible common ground with Republicans, building U.S. infrastructure and boosting U.S. exports. He said he will meet with Republican congressional leaders Friday to get a sense of their agenda and determine potential areas of collaboration. Mr. Obama said in the next few weeks, he hopes to work with lawmakers on boosting funding for those on the front lines of the Ebola fight in West Africa and getting congressional authorization for the use of military force in the battle against the Islamic State.
The world needs to know we are united behind this effort, and the men and women of our military deserve our clear and unified support.
One area where the president stood firm is immigration. He said he had hoped Congress would pass comprehensive reform that would strengthen the borders, improve the U.S. economy, and give an opportunity for those who are undocumented. But in the absence of such congressional action, Mr. Obama said he is prepared to act on his own and use his executive authority on immigration before the end of the year.
What I'm not going to do is just wait. I think it's fair to say that I've shown a lot of patience and have tried to work on a bipartisan basis as much as possible. And I'm going to keep on doing so. But in the meantime, let's figure out what we can do lawfully through executive actions to improve the functioning of the existing system.
Through the more than an hour-long press briefing, Mr. Obama deflected questions on whether he is a lame duck president and how it feels to be rejected by members of his own party who distanced themselves during the midterm campaign. Instead, Mr. Obama said he is optimistic about America's future and plans to spend his last 2 years continuing to work hard for the American people. Aru Pandey, VOA News, The White House.
Will the shift in Congress have an impact on U.S.-Russian relations? VOA senior correspondent Andre Dineshna looks at the issue in this report from Washington.
The ongoing crisis in Ukraine has damaged relations between Washington and Moscow. Some experts believe they are at their lowest point in decades. Now that the Republican Party controls both houses of Congress, will that have an effect on U.S.-Russia relations? John Parker is a Russia expert at the National Defense University.
Probably will not have that much of an impact because the administration was so weak domestically here already that it was factoring in, if not a shellacking at these midterm elections, then a situation in which its domestic support wasn't any greater.
Mount Holyoke College Russia expert Stephen Jones agrees.
Nothing dramatic will change the result of this election in terms of U.S.-Russian relations. You will hear perhaps stronger voices from the Senate at times of crisis with Russia, maybe a push to try and take more aggressive actions in terms of the embargo that the U.S. has instituted at some level, but nothing dramatic, I wouldn't think.
Columbia University professor Robert Legvold says the Obama administration will continue its policy towards Russia, first and foremost trying to isolate Moscow from the international arena.
Secondly, to maintain the sanctions, and if things go the wrong direction in Ukraine, to increase the pressure for more sanctions, working with the Europeans in order to do that. In the meantime, strengthening our defense options for dealing with and what we see as an increased Russian threat in Central Europe through NATO.
Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger told VOA Russia has to be an integral part of any international system.
I think even more now that it is important to find a way to bring Russia and the other countries into a cooperative relationship.
Looking ahead, experts say Russian President Vladimir Putin is biding his time, waiting for the next U.S. presidential election in 2016. In the meantime, Robert Legvold says there is very little will, either in Washington or Moscow, to turn the relationship around.
We're more or less in our leadership stuck on the notion that the other side is a fundamental problem, indeed even an adversary at this point.
Legvold and others say that same sentiment is prevalent in Moscow. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
As we reported earlier this week, the Israeli finance minister has warned that Israeli-U.S. relations are in a crisis mode and need repair. VOA's Cecily Hillary discussed the relationship between the Obama administration and the Netanyahu government with David Makovsky, the Ziegler Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute.
Look, I think what's happened is that when, you know, you have two parties dealing with each other for 6 years, in the case of the Obama administration and the Netanyahu government, and there's now we're in our third Netanyahu government, our second Obama administration, when you have two parties dealing with each other for 6 years, what happens is that there's baggage that accumulates, and sometimes the sum is comes across as greater than its parts. So I think, you know, that there's been differences over issues like the settlements question. The issue with Yalon is actually an old story from a year ago. And even the settlement issue, which has attracted a lot of attention, you know, actually the Israeli settlement activity is an area that plausibly will be part of Israel in any two-state solution. But because they don't clarify that publicly and saying, we're only building here, we will not build in the other areas, which they're largely not building in anyway, there's a certain confusion sets in that they're out to preclude a two-state solution. And so when Israel doesn't clarify, that lack of clarity is not and distinction is not made by others, including the United States.
Well, it strikes me that Netanyahu and Obama have a lot in common in that they're both trying to sort of walk a very delicate line between right and left. But Gaza and the settlements and whatever, that's not the only issue right now on the table. There's also the Iran nuclear talks.
Right. But it's too soon on that one to say if there's going to be greater tension between the parties. I mean, the gaps, according to what we read in the press, are substantial. And we don't know if they will be bridged by November 24th. And if so, will that be a result of Iran, you know, coming down in its demands, or the United States, you know, trying to accommodate Iran? So I think without knowing whether there will be a breakthrough, and if the breakthrough is because, you know, Obama went more towards the Iranians and the Iranians came towards Obama, it's too hard, I think, and almost unfair to say that that is, you know, that there's some real active tension. Are there fears? On both sides, yes. On the Israeli side, there's a fear that Obama will be too accommodating. And on the Obama side, there's a fear that Israel's going to be too critical without knowing the specifics. So the fears are kind of hovering out there. But I wouldn't say that it has been a driving force at this time. And, you know, according to media reports, there's a chance that it might roll over. I mean, that there'll be another extension for another 6 months, so we'll kind of be back where we are now. So I don't, you know, I would be careful in saying that this is, you know, a point of, you know, of major contention. It's out there. There's no question it's out there. It's hovering. But it's not an acute point given the lack of certainty on how those talks are going to be resolved.
Israel and the U.S. have certainly had their differences in the past, and there's been snubbing in the past. I think back to Clinton and Netanyahu, and remember when Netanyahu met with the evangelicals and with Jerry Falwell. We could forget. And Kissinger blowing up with Yitzhak Rabin. But the fundamental relationship, how would you characterize it?
Yeah, no, I think that it's rock solid. Someone has described it's too big to fail at this point. I mean, it is, there's been the breadth and depth of the relationship has really grown with the years. At the very time that people talk about Yellen's visit, his meeting with the Secretary of Defense, Hagel, supposedly went very well. The military-to-military relationship is excellent. So I think we have to be careful not to reduce the relationship into a soundbite.
Mm-hmm.
But and unfortunately, when certain adversaries of the relationship see a lot of daylight, in between the parties, they sometimes want to drive a truck through it and create a wedge even further. So I think the fundamentals are strong. But I think at the same time, and intellectual honesty requires us to say that there's been tensions. But I don't think these tensions are going to be decisive in any way in terms of, toppling the relationship.
David Makovsky, Ziegler Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute and Director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process. Since the Egyptian military took power in July 2013, Egypt has become one of the most dangerous countries for journalists. At least 6 journalists have been killed, and dozens of others have been detained. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy discussed what threats currently exist for the press in Egypt with Stephen McNerney, Executive Director of Project on Middle East Democracy.
Unfortunately, press freedom in Egypt is extraordinarily restricted right now. The current government has gone to a further extent than we've seen from any previous Egyptian government in limiting press freedom. There have been an enormous number of journalists arrested that are currently imprisoned in Egypt. There have been lots of intimidation of journalists. There have been censorship of articles. Unfortunately, it's just simply not a place in which journalists feel as though they can operate freely and safely.
Can you give me some examples of the deterioration that is attached to the freedom of speech in Egypt?
Sure. The first thing I would say is that in terms of, there have actually been a number of journalists, both imprisoned, as I mentioned, and also killed. The Committee to Protect Journalists currently ranks Egypt as the third deadliest country in the world right now for journalists after Syria and Iraq. And this is shocking, and obviously people are very familiar with how dangerous Syria and Iraq would be for journalists. People are very shocked to learn that Egypt ranks just after this. There have been, of course, the very high-profile imprisonments and trials of several correspondents for Al Jazeera, including Al Jazeera English, that have included Western nationals, Australian nationals, in addition to dozens of Egyptian journalists that have been imprisoned. There have been countless instances of direct threats, intimidation of journalists, as well as threats, intimidation of sources for working with journalists. We've recently seen examples of newspapers being removed, having all print copies of newspapers being removed from circulation because of a particular article that has offended the government. And unfortunately, all of this activity and actions against the press in Egypt seems to only be increasing.
But in his speech at the United Nations General Assembly, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi said his new Egypt would guarantee freedom of speech. How would that promise be reconciled with what you said?
The simple answer is that the promise was insincere, and that and it's not the only insincere promise that the President al-Sisi has made. He's promised to respect the rights and freedoms of citizens, not only of speech, but more broadly of freedom of expression, also freedom of assembly and association, while at the same time his government has been escalating a crackdown against civil society and also they have an extremely repressive demonstrations law that's not in line with international standards. So I think, unfortunately, this government is demonstrating a pattern of having public statements and commitments to respect freedoms in line with international standards, but their practice seems to be consistently at direct odds with this.
President Sisi explicitly instructed journalists to refrain from what he called agitating the public, saying that the media needs to preserve the integrity of the Egyptian state. What do you make of that approach?
I think that, once again, it goes along with the broader approach of President Sisi and his government, in that they are trying to sort of frame their crackdowns on dissenting voices and their crackdowns on freedoms, basic freedoms, including freedom of speech and expression and assembly. They're trying to frame all of this in terms of their protecting the state and in terms of their efforts to combat terrorism. But unfortunately, they have, you know, excessively broad definitions in which they have deemed any criticism of the state to be regarded as undermining the state, or not just criticism of the state, but even criticism of the government or of officials in the government or in the military as threatening to the state and reputation of the state, and therefore constituting terrorism. So this is a not terribly unusual but very dangerous approach that's being taken, and I don't think that he's fooling many observers, particularly international observers, in terms of this rhetoric.
Stephen McNerney, Executive Director of Project on Middle East Democracy. Tomorrow we'll speak with him about the importance of a free press in Egypt. The U.S. and Liberian governments have opened a 25-bed Ebola treatment unit outside Monrovia to treat health workers infected with the virus. Providing high-quality care is considered key to recruiting local Liberian staff and convincing much-needed Western health workers to come battle the Ebola epidemic. VOA's Ann Look has the story.
It took the U.S. military 5 weeks to transform a swampy field outside Monrovia into an Ebola field hospital, built and stocked according to MSF and WHO guidelines. The air-conditioned medical unit has 25 beds and is staffed by 70 officers from the U.S. Public Health Service. It's the first Ebola treatment unit, or ETU, built specifically for health workers. It is equipped to provide a, quote, high level of care, says U.S. Acting Deputy Surgeon General Rear Admiral Scott F. Giberson.
This facility is a beacon. A beacon that signals to all healthcare workers and responders from Liberia and all other nations to come to Liberia and join in the response. We are here to help, to bring safety and security to the courageous young men and women who are serving in our front lines.
Health workers run a high risk of contracting Ebola because they can come in contact with the blood and other bodily fluids of Ebola patients. The disease has decimated the ranks of West African medical workers, killing more than 300, more than half of them in Liberia. Many died in the early days of the epidemic when they did not have necessary gear or training to protect themselves. Rapid access to supportive care can improve an Ebola patient's chance of survival. This new medical unit will be able to provide IV rehydration therapy, medication to alleviate symptoms, and close monitoring of electrolytes and vital signs. This advanced level of care has not been available at local Ebola treatment units. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf toured the new Monrovia Medical Unit this week. She said health workers have made, quote, the ultimate sacrifice and deserve the best possible care. Ann Look, VOA News, Dakar.
China is planning to send about 1,000 medical workers and experts to West Africa to bolster the more than 250 already in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, the three countries hardest hit by the Ebola epidemic. The official Xinhua news agency says China has contributed more than $120 million to 13 African countries and international organizations to fight the deadly virus. The American Association for the Advancement of Science reports China has one of the largest aid operations, driven in part by its increasing political and business interests in Africa. George Gao, Deputy Director General of the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention, operates a mobile testing laboratory in the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown, where he says his team performs up to 60 blood tests a day. A veteran of successful efforts to contain the H7N5 and H7N9 strains of avian influenza in China, Gao and his team have been in Freetown since mid-September and are expected to stay until the middle of November when the new team rotates in. Another team from Beijing's 302 Military Hospital, which took the lead during the 2003 outbreak of SARS, is operating a holding center to keep suspected Ebola patients under quarantine. In coming weeks, hundreds of members of China's People Liberation Army will arrive in Liberia to build a 100-bed treatment center. China is also set to deliver 60 ambulances, 100 motorcycles, and other supplies, including pickup trucks and incinerators. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports that the Vigon Lakeland Safety Products Factory in eastern Shandong Province is assembling protective suits for the frontline Chinese personnel at the rate of 6,000 a day, with plans to double that capacity by January. Nelson Lee, head of infectious diseases at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the city was caught by surprise by SARS, and the successful response to it offers lessons for those battling Ebola.
After the SARS outbreak, Hong Kong did a lot to improve the system. In every major hospital in Hong Kong now, we do have isolation facilities. So that's negative pressure airborne isolation rooms with reasonably good facilities. The personal protective equipment, like the masks and gowns, gloves, are now everywhere in the hospital, so you can use it anytime. There's a government structure formed after SARS. In Hong Kong, we call it the Center for Health Protection. Its function is similar to CDC in U.S. It investigates outbreaks. It positions itself as the center for communication during outbreaks and also public health education. So with all these systems in place, we are successful in passing through some of the threats, including the 209 H1N1 and more recently the MERS coronavirus and now Ebola. So I think that compared to year 2003, we are in a much better position.
The Ebola outbreak was first detected in March. We're now in November. Did it take this long for SARS to come under control, or did it take just a matter of weeks?
That's a very different disease, I would say. So I can't really compare them directly. For SARS coronavirus, it was first detected in Hong Kong in about March 2003, and the outbreak started to die down in about late June 2003. So in Hong Kong, it lasted for about 3 months, and is under control, and that's obviously a joint effort by the community as well as all the healthcare professionals. I guess in Africa, the situation is quite different because the infrastructure for healthcare is very deficient. And also the virus is very different in terms of its transmission nature.
With thousands of Chinese living and working in Africa, how vulnerable is China to contracting Ebola, bringing Ebola back to the mainland?
Well, in Hong Kong, I think the traffic between West Africa and Hong Kong citizens are not frequent. I would say it's very infrequent. But we understand that there's a big African community in the southern parts of China, which is in the Guangdong province, right next to Hong Kong. And of course, if they bring the virus from Africa directly to mainland China and spread the disease there, if there's sustained transmission, there might be a chance that some of these cases might slip through and go into Hong Kong. There is a small risk in that. But I think that judging from the transmissibility of the infection so far, apparently, the virus is not easily spread during travels. Otherwise, we should be seeing a lot of cases contracting the virus on the airplane, judging from the experience from Europe and America. So I think that theoretically, we will few cases slipping through the border from mainland China to Hong Kong if there is sustained transmission. But the chance of widespread transmission in Hong Kong, I think, is not high.
Nelson Lee, head of infectious diseases at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.